This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Brock Cash, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen in by phone calling 716-748-0144, or if you have a smartphone or a computer, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to Station 2, and click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests. Toll-free, USA, Canada, 888-429-5471. Tonight's guest, former ambassador to Iraq, Edward Peck, will be joining us. He is a retired career U.S. diplomat who served 32 years foreign services. He's been a foreign service diplomat to many nations throughout the Middle East. Let's welcome him here tonight. Good evening, Edward. How are you, sir?
Sir, I'm fine, and I'm just outside the Washington, D.C. and Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Edward, fill us in a little bit on your expertise and your time in Iraq as a diplomat, and also what your perception is on what's going on these days.
Well, that's quite a task. I have served in six Arab countries, Muslim countries. The Iraq assignment took place in 1977, and I was there until 1980. I speak Arabic and was already pretty familiar with and introduced to and comfortable with the Muslim societies in relatively developed countries, and Iraq was certainly one of them. I think one of the things that I need to say is that the Americans got a very skewed view of what Iraq was all about, politically, economically, culturally, and certainly militarily, for various reasons which could be debated at some length and still not be resolved. But I was in Baghdad just a year and a half ago, invited to a conference there. It's a country I'm willing to say that I know fairly well. I traveled about in the country, and I've been there since, and have followed very closely all of the things that have happened. Let's let that serve as an introduction, with all modesty.
And what do you think about what Bush and Cheney and all the rhetoric they put out to get us into a war with Iraq?
Well, I think you've described it accurately. I can recall having heard Vice President Cheney say at one point that as soon as Saddam Hussein was removed from power, democracy would burst into bloom all over the Middle East. And that is on the far edges of likelihood. And in fact, you could even describe as highly unlikely, given the nature of the situation in any part of the world where one change like that doesn't necessarily result in a sweeping change, whether it's good or bad. And they had good information from the intelligence community that Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction, which, of course, was eventually proven at some cost. But nonetheless, despite what the intelligence community said and what other people were saying, the United States government remained convinced that he had to be removed because of the threat he posed to the United States, of which there was none. Perhaps the best example of this is a man whose character and reputation is not besmirched, and that is Colin Powell, who was led to make his presentation at the United Nations on the weapons of mass destruction using, phony information, which he was given as being factual. So the United States wanted to go to war with Saddam Hussein for whatever reasons. you wish to ascribe, and we did, and totally ignoring what had happened when Marshal Tito finally was removed or was departed from ruling Yugoslavia, and everybody expected Yugoslavia to flower and prosper once Marshal Tito was gone, and we saw what happened there. The place collapsed. We since have seen it in Iraq and in Libya, and now we seem to be pushing it in Syria, not having learned that many societies, which are different from ours in many ways, require and operate best if they are run with what could only be described as a fairly tight hand. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, and what do you think of this situation with ISIS and who is behind ISIS? What is ISIS? And is it more rhetoric to impose attacks on Syria rather than attacking them in Iraq?
Well, it is probably one of the most convoluted situations which I have ever observed. In what we're doing in Syria, to some extent, is fighting the people who were fighting with Bashar al-Assad, whom we had always said, you know, had to leave. But I think it is safe to say, and I'm quite certain it is accurate to say, that our understanding of the situation in Syria before and in Iraq before was sadly distorted by the people who wanted it to come out that way. I offer this as an illustration. When I was in Iraq, the country was run by an organization called the Ba'ath Party, which in Arabic means, how would you call it, Renaissance, I think it was. And it's a secular organization, the Ba'ath Party. All Arabs of whatever tendency, all Iraqis of whatever political or religious orientation, were equal citizens. Women were liberated. My principal point of contact in the foreign ministry had her master's degree from George Washington University. The country was booming economically. They had lots of money, and it's a socialist government with schools and hospitals and roads and irrigation and lights and all sorts of things. The government, the cabinet, had Shia, Sunni, Christians, and Kurds in it, and they were willing and able to stand in the path of Iranian expansion. And none of that is left. It's all gone.
So who is this that they're doing all this fighting for? This is the understanding that I can't get through my head. Who is behind all of this, and what is your assumption on who is behind all of this?
Well, you see, it goes back a long way. But let's cut it fairly short. After World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the League of Nations gave to England and France and others mandates to run certain parts of that area of the world. Britain got Iraq, France got Syria, and so forth. And their mandate was to set up a government with solid democratic institutions and a good police force and stamp out corruption and fix it so they could defend their borders and so on. But the British and the French drew lines separating tribe from tribe and religion from religion and language from language and cut it up in a way that made it unstable to begin with. And it's worth mentioning at this point, I think, sir, that while Britain was trying to do all these things in Iraq, it cut off a piece of Iraq called now Kuwait, which would explain why Iraqis saw Kuwait differently than we did. The French did the same thing in Syria when they cut off Lebanon and made that a separate country, which is why Syrians look at Lebanon differently than others. But now, with the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime and the efforts by others with the help of the United States to instigate a whole new form of government, I think the place has probably come apart forever. Here in America, we talk about the Shia and the Sunni and the Kurds, but that leaves out the Turkmen. I think there's over 2 million of them. the Turkmen and the Yazidis and the Mandaeans and the Shabak and the Christians and the very small but still remaining Jewish community, they're really out of it, because if the country becomes partitioned, and we have seen this happen elsewhere, people who don't get across the border into their own place will suffer. And some of these groups won't have a place.
Right. So who was behind the League of Nations, and what was the League of Nations before it became the United Nations?
The League of Nations was not an organization we belonged to. You remember that our president at that time didn't want to get us involved in that sort of thing. So the League of Nations marched on, and it was powerful, and it stepped in to do good things in places where folks weren't necessarily ready for the good things that the League of Nations had in mind, or the way in which it was done. So while the British were there, there were various uprisings and revolutions and attacks and so forth, and after they left, one government after another fell and was, you know, overrun and over. It was a terrible thing. They put in as a king a man from another country, and, you know, that isn't going to work well either. So it was, forgive the expression, because it can be a good thing, it was imperialism in full flower and unfortunate. So this is what we are left to deal with now, because in Afghanistan, which is not yet really ready to enter the modern world, and in Syria, and in Iraq, and in Lebanon, and in places like that, which we are watching very carefully now, the entire structure of the population is something that we don't really understand, because we've never experienced it.
Okay. Well, you know, we have the mainstream media. They seem to be overplaying the step and inciting fear into the hearts of the American public. Why? Why are they doing this?
Well, the media, you know, sells advertising and sells papers. And, you know, no news is good news. But this is the sort of thing in which, well, look, let's put it this way. We spend an awful lot of time on television watching people discuss these areas without ever having been there or knowing anything about it. And in the older days, we used to have newscasters, you know, presented the news. Now it's all commentary. And what you want to do is to get the people to buy your paper and to watch your TV show and to buy the products. And a lot, of course, of them believe that what they're saying is accurate, but it's embarrassing to me. I'll take it back. It's frightening to me to see people on television discussing Iraq, for example, in great detail, without ever really having been there, let alone living there, let alone speaking the language, let alone having any area experience, because what they are doing is what they want to do without any solid basis and background. I have lost a lot of respect for our media.
That makes two of us. My next question to you is, what is your insight on ISIS? Because my investigations led me to a website of an American contractor, a corporation here in John McCain State, that is called ISIS, and they're a military corporation, just like Blackwater's. And one of their things is they role play, and another factor is that they are the security for the royalty in Saudi Arabia, and of course the emirs in Qatar also. So, what's your perception on it?
Well, you know, folks in that business don't want the problems to go away. I don't mean to say that they're trying to stir them up, but as long as there are problems, that they are profitable and doing work that they feel competent in doing. But it is so difficult for us as a nation, leaving aside the people in ISIS. Many of them may have had considerable experience in that part of the world. I don't know who's involved. But as we have seen with our own, forgive the expression, Secret Service, you know, some of these organizations begin to become somewhat different in terms of what they're doing, and than what they were supposed to be doing when initially established or hired or created. Security being what it is, one of the things you have to do is keep people frightened. And as long as they're frightened, you can do whatever you want with them.
Well, I believe that there shouldn't be a secret security service or secret anything when it comes to our government. Everything should be put out in full exposure to the public. If you were in a country that was doing right by the means and the ways of the people, there would be no reason for anybody to want to threaten the security of that person or entity.
That certainly isn't a desirable objective, but there can always be people out there who wouldn't follow what you just laid out as a logical, rational approach. If you look around the world, in almost anywhere, you can find an extraordinarily wide range of attitudes, beliefs, or procedures in any community. I offer you an illustration, if I can. We had a Secretary of State who 3 years ago said, quote, "America's role is to remake the world in our image." Well, which image did you have in mind there, Bayonne, New Jersey, or San Francisco, California? Is it Alabama or New Hampshire? Because we have a wide range of people who have strongly held views on guns, on marriage, on homosexuality, on income, on taxes, all of these things. Sometimes it explodes into violence. We've certainly had experience with that. So that you're unlikely to ever get a nation in which everybody, forgive this, I don't mean it to be funny, sitting around campfires drinking steaming mugs of cocoa and singing Kumbaya. You'll get groups that'll do that, but not great big ones.
Right. I was watching a video of you earlier back in 2011 or 2012 where you were addressing a community of Ramallites in San Francisco. Let's jump to the Palestinian issue. What is your thoughts and concerns about what's going on there and the ongoing struggle of the Palestinians and the Israeli onslaught and genocide?
Well, here's the thing. In my mind, no rational person, no reasonably rational person, and you and I both recognize that not everyone will qualify for inclusion in that group, no rational person wants anything bad to happen to one Israeli, one Palestinian, one American, one anybody. But the horrible fact is that horrible things have happened, are happening, and unfortunately are going to happen, I hope I'm wrong, because of what is and is not happening in Gaza, in Jerusalem, and in the West Bank, where I have been many times. It's unfortunate as the dickens, because history shows us that this has been tried before. The Middle East, which is the bridge between Asia, Africa, and Europe, has been overrun, invaded, and conquered, and occupied, 16 times in recorded history. And as you look around the Middle East, you find the ruins of a Crusader castle up on the hills in Lebanon, and you find a Greek port and a Roman headquarters, and Ottomans and the Assyrians, and all of these people have come in and set up governments and run things, and they're all gone. They're all gone. Because it's difficult to do that in that part of the world for any length of time. I think the Crusaders were the shortest, 110 years. But if all of us can agree, every single person, I think, can agree that what we want to see out there is all of the peoples in that area living in peace and security. But the definition is that if all of them are living in peace and security, that's fine. But one of them can't if the others aren't. And that's what leaves me concerned, and a lot of other people concerned, in Israel as well, as to the end result of what is being done there now, which flies in the face of everything that our nation continuously bellows it stands for, freedom, justice, liberty, human rights, international law. But when we keep doing that, but don't push it everywhere, then you come across as hypocrite. And every nation is hypocritical to some extent, but none of them are world powers in our league.
Right. And what in your consensus, what is the best way to get our government to cease and desist on its imperialistic movement?
I don't know. I've become quite concerned at the path on which our nation seems to be launched. And try this for you. You may quote me. By definition, you cannot impose democracy. Democracy is something that rises from the bottom up, not from the top down, and certainly not from the outside in. And you cannot force people to make a free choice, although we appear to be trying almost everywhere. And the difficulty is that it creates instability. And the problem with instability is that unless a country is stable, it's very difficult for good things to happen. You have to have stability so that you can work towards agreed goals that the population has. And they won't be able to express those goals unless they have stability. And our involvement has destabilized the whole area, knocking off Saddam Hussein, who was badly misrepresented in the American media, set in off a chain reaction, which is going to take an awful long time. I fear, I hope I'm wrong, an awful long time to be resolved.
You've worked in the intelligence field for a little bit. Is this just to, disrupt the nations and to impose democracy, or is it about stealing the nation's wealth and taking away the socialist countries that were doing things that were good for their people and putting everybody into the debt situation that we are facing here in the United States? Because I remember when education was pretty much free, insurance was paid for by the companies, and it wasn't so expensive. Is this what they're trying to impose on all the other nations, and that is to put everybody into a phase of debt?
No, I don't think that's the objective. I don't think that's the conscious goal. But what you just described very accurately is probably the logical end result of a capitalist society. We refer to ourselves as a capitalist free market society, and indeed we are, where capitalism, money, becomes one of the key things that people have. So that in some countries in the world, especially I think in the Buddhist countries, where inner peace is the, nirvana is the goal that everybody wants to reach, is that inner peace. Whereas in America, it's a swimming pool and a fancy car. So that if you've seen the figures that were in a poll, the Americans thought that the CEOs were making 30 times more than the workers, and it turns out that it's 230 times more than the workers. Well, this is kind of unfair. You get a lot of inequality that way. And we have a dream that every nation would be kind of like us, but that's not very logical, not very likely. But similar to us in the sense that they don't bother their neighbors and they don't make it too tough on their inhabitants. I think that's what every American would agree is a logical goal, but we seem to be set out on a path to do it by force of arms, and you cannot introduce democracy on the point of a bayonet. That is not going to work, especially, I think, in a country that doesn't know what democracy is or how it works, and may be perfectly happy with the way they are running things without outside interference. Nobody likes outside interference, and we seem to be introducing that in every place we can think of.
Well, nobody wants anybody coming into their home and telling them what to do. And
oh my friend, you are so right.
We don't want that, and I'm sure that people need to understand that other people want the same kind of respect where they don't want anybody coming into their homes. I mean, here in the United States, we're having a hard time with NSA and the government overimposing itself on different factions here in the United States that are doing things that they legally and constitutionally have rights to do. My next question to you comes from a listener in California, Don in California. And his question is, it seems the Ayatollah regime and ISIS have much in common, a hard Islamist ideology and anti-Israel, anti-U.S. attitudes. ISIS and the totally of the jihadist world are Sunni, and they consider Shia Islam, Iranian Islam, to be infidel. Tehran is caught in between a rock and a hard place, and would it be all more so Sunni jihadist relations in the West and more likely to a lead to a nuclear deal within the outside powers, because the enemy of my enemy is the ally of my friend, faced with all ties, what should Israel do?
Boy, I tell you, that is quite a question. Prime Minister Netanyahu were to ask me that question, I think I would say to him, you know, my friend, he's a man I have met here in Washington when he was stationed at the embassy. My friend, try to resolve the problems in such a way that you can live in peace with your neighbors. And I don't think that he's ready for that, because it's become a little messianic. You know, and when people talk about Muslims being, you know, savage killers and all of that, I don't believe that the Nazis were Muslims, for example, or the people up in Northern Ireland who were fighting and killing each other for so long. I don't believe they were Muslims either, nor were the 600,000 Americans who were killed by other Americans here in our own civil war. So I think it's a little illogical to pick one group, because agnostics know how to kill if they want. In the situation with Israel facing a great deal of outside pressure and some still inside as a result of what they have done and are doing to the prostrate Palestinian population, it's probably not, I'll take it back, it's surely not in Israel's long-term best interests. You can do it for a while, it's been done for a while, but you can't sustain yourself forever in the face of hostility from all sides. And part of the problem in the Middle East for us, for our country, is that the Muslims, the Arabs, see us as supporting and defending and arming and financing Israel, and they don't like that, which reduces our ability to come in and play the role of mediator, because they recognize, as we do ourselves, that we have a dog in this fight, and no slur intended, we have somebody in the struggle in that area that we will defend at all costs, as our Congress and President keep telling us. And that costs us in terms of what we can and could do in dealing with the people in that part of the world. And it's not going to be easily correctable. It isn't something that you overcome quickly. And referring back to something that you and I just talked about a moment ago, nobody wants anybody to come into their house and tell them, for example, how to raise their children. But even more than that, they don't want them going outside the house and telling everybody else that we're not raising our children right. And we do that all the time. Every American leader who goes out to some country comes out of the meeting and tells the press exactly what they told the people inside the presidential palace, which is criticism, basically. You're not doing this right, and we told them they have to stop doing this and start doing that. And no one has given us the right to do that.
I concur with you 1,000%. And with that being said, I have one question for you. Why? Why are we doing this? Why is the United States only supporting Israel? And, you know, what is it that has us doing that?
Well, we have in this country a democratic system, so-called, And the democratic system operates with what we call lobbies. Lobby is not a dirty word. Lobby can be a group of people who get together to want to have trees planted in the center of the city hall square. So lobbies work to tell the government, the elected government, individuals, what it is we'd like to have them do or not do. And in the United States, there is a very powerful group that is very happy with the fact that we are arming and supporting and financing and protecting Israel. That's what they want. And there really isn't anybody on the other side of that question, for all the reasons that you're familiar with, and perhaps many of your listeners as well, who are very hesitant to speak out on this question. Because when President Obama points out, as he did a couple of times, or when other members of our government point out that Syrian refugees, you know, have been in refugee camps for 3.5 years, in Syria there are refugee camps that have been occupied by Palestinians for 48 years, but we don't say anything about that because it's not popular in this country. It's not, everybody else knows about it. The problem that we face is that all of our leaders keep bellowing about American exceptionalism. And so there are two serious facets to this thing. One is Americans are convinced that they know everything about the rest of the world. That's called arrogance. And the other side of the question is that they really don't know anything about the rest of the world, and that's called ignorance. Not ignorance, mental ignorance, but just not knowing what it's all about. And so we listen to our leaders and we listen to the media, and we come away with a badly warped impression of what it's all about and what to do to fix it. Well, you can't fix it. You can't make Alabama like New Hampshire or vice versa, because they're different. They have all kinds of differences, and we've seen that in gun laws. We've seen that in, abortion. We've seen that in all kinds of things in which Americans are very strongly and fiercely divided. And if you take that and apply it to other places where there's a different history, a different background, a different religion, a different culture, a different structure, our rules don't necessarily apply there, certainly not in the short run.
I can agree. I can agree with that 1,000%. Once again, nobody likes to be told what to do. And, if I want to keep my guns, I want to keep my guns. And if I don't, I don't. That's, my prerogative. That is my humanistical freedom that I have from God. And for somebody to impose their will, their way on the rest of society because they don't care to see it my way, then there, I see those people as the people that are having the problem. Let's go to our caller on that's waiting. We have Mike in California. Go ahead, Mike.
Hello, Rock. Hello, Ambassador Peck, or former Ambassador Peck. I'm going to be upfront and honest with you. I do not trust the United States government regarding its foreign policy. I don't believe they're there to help anybody in the Middle East. I think it's about totally self-serving interests. I mean, if you look at what's been going on, they bombed the heck out of Iraq, destroying that country, killing God knows how many people, and now they're rebombing it. This time it's a Democratic president, a Nobel Peace Laureate to boot, who is placing the new face of terrorism on a group that I feel the United States is responsible for training and arming, and they're supplying the opposition as well, creating a situation of non-ending war. I'm over all of that. I'm for when is the prosecution of that former president, President Bush, and possibly this present one, going to ever happen? I know it's not likely to happen, but I feel realistically that is what should be done. How do you feel about that?
Well, sir, I sense that you have strongly held beliefs on this, and I prosecuting the president, I think it's perhaps useful to remember that the president of the United States, under most circumstances, is neither a king nor an emperor. He's got a political party. He has a Congress, which sometimes is working. He has the electorate. He has the media. So that his actions or her actions, when that day comes, are affected to a very large degree by what other people want. because he can't do anything he wants anytime he wants to do it, although sometimes that happens, or something close to it. And I think that the prosecuting President Bush, who did what he thought was right, I think he was seriously misled. And President Obama, who is reluctant to go down the same path that Bush followed, you know, where, but circumstances fixed it.
Well,
go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, but this is where common sense needs to come into play, and we do need leaders with common sense. You're there to lead. You don't follow what is being propagated to you. And Mike, let me correct you. I'm concerned with both international and domestic situations that our government is stepping up to do, especially with the arming of the police and turning it into a police state. I think we're heading for some dire times, and I do believe that any president that intentionally lies to the American public needs to be prosecuted, because we know that the everything that was put out were lies, not only by the statements made prior, but the statements made post the war all show that they were willingly lying to go into Iraq. And I think that needs to be handled, and I believe that it needs to be done, and I believe that there needs to be a grand jury put in place right away.
Well, okay, now, Mike, by the way, I'm from California. I was born and raised out there in West Los Angeles. The issue is that the president, calls in his trusted assistants and said, okay, what's the situation? And they tell him. They tell him what they want to tell him, and that's what he has to work with. So when they accuse of some cabinet secretary of not knowing what was going on, you know, in his cabinet, in his organization, when you're in charge of something and you can't be in every room every minute of every day, you don't know what's happening unless somebody tells you. So you turn to them and say, what is the situation in Iraq? But don't you remember how we were terribly upset about the Sandinistas in Latin America Central America, who were going to appear on the border of Texas? And how if South Vietnam fall, communism would sweep over the whole area? You know, this is how you whip up enthusiasm to do things in various places from an American public that is not terribly knowledgeable and isn't necessarily terribly interested, as long as they don't bother us over there. So the president is kind of trapped in a sense, in that he has no way to go out to, you know, picture a place, take Syria, and meet with Bashar al-Assad and talk with him, because his people won't let him. And you can remember that we opened the door to China, a country in which we were at daggers drawn for so long. The idea was, as the President of the United States said, let's build relations with them without forgetting that we have differences. But we haven't really talked to Iran, you know, since 1980. And we didn't talk to Iraq for an 11-year period. Well, talking to people is one of the ways you can help reduce or even remove problems, because if you don't talk to them, there's no chance at all.
Well, I think that the American public definitely needs to talk to the government and start putting these people out of place, because there is nobody above the law, Ambassador, and that also, you know, holds point direct also to the presidential office. Factors are factors, and you know the rush to war and the rush to support the industrialized military complex is not working for the American people.
You're right about that. You're right about that. And but you said, you know, the American people have to make these changes, and they do that through the electoral system. And that is a little bit skewed as well. If you were to ask me what I would propose and suggest for America, but it's a little late now, is that I would urge us to step back and let the rest of the world work out some of its own problems. because our military-industrial complex has become enormous. Throw in the intelligence business, throw in the weapons manufacturers, throw in the media, who, you know, gets more business this way than any other way, and we have serious problems. And I agree with you. I fear that we are in for a long and difficult time in this world, where every nation is a lot closer together than they were before, not necessarily geographically, but in terms of travel and communications and so forth. But as long as Americans are being told that we are exceptional and that our job is to run the world, well, we're going to have this kind of difficulty until people figure out that that probably is not only not a good idea, but it's not possible.
Well, that is a fact. I've got a question for you from Israel. What do you think about Bibi and his speech at the UN?
Well, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu is an intelligent man. There's no question about that. And he's a dynamic leader. And when he speaks to the United Nations and lines up all of the complaints that Israel has about the rest of the world, you know, being against it, I think he has tremendous difficulty in seeing that some of these problems are created by Israel itself and its behavior. I gave you the last Gaza. They keep talking about, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There really isn't a conflict. Conflicts are between nations. What you have is a very repressive occupation, and according to the United Nations Charter, people who are occupied have the right to resist. But in our country, we only talk about Israel's right to defend itself. Well, I certainly agree that Israel has every right to defend itself, but some of these things it brings on itself by making Gaza into the world's largest fresh air prison with occasional attacks that level it. And so he seized with the opportunity, the occasion to speak to the leaders of the free world, is certainly can be expected to push the Israeli point of view on all these issues, because he recognizes that not only, well, he thinks not only are they dead wrong, but they're also dangerous for Israel. And they are.
And what do you think of his comparison that Hamas is ISIS and ISIS is Hamas? He's putting out a bunch of rhetoric, in my belief.
Yeah, and I think that those two groups are different. I happened to be in Gaza in 2006 when they had the election. I was a UN observer there. And there were damn near more observers than there were people voting. But I went from city to city and watched and looked, and I was with a group of people who also were knowledgeable and experienced, and everyone agreed that the election was free and fair and honest. But look what they did. They elected people that we didn't want. And this, of course, is one of the key problems with the democracy. You might lose. So we were very strongly in favor of them holding elections there. They'd been held earlier, you remember, up in the West Bank. I was there for that as well. But they chose people that they wanted and not people that we wanted, so we immediately labeled them a terrorist organization. Ta-da, that's easy to do. But there is a, you know, I was, if you're aware of this, I was the deputy director of the Cabinet Task Force on Terrorism in the Reagan administration on detail to the White House, 1985. And people kept coming in and laying this in front of us. It's painful. It's horrible to think about. But it's true. One man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. Because it all depends on which side you're on. If our guys are doing it, it's good. If their other guys are doing it, it's bad.
So, well, I was going to come to that. We seem to be doing the terrorizing worldwide and just pointing the finger at other people being a terrorist.
All right, let me do something for you and for your listeners. There is the U.S. Code. It's the compilation of U.S. laws. And if you look at Title 18, Section 21, Article 3121, you will find the U.S. legal definition of international terrorism. This was not written by the Cabinet Task Force, because every time the working group, of which I was the deputy director, sent up a definition of terrorism, which they asked us to do, they rejected it. by saying it, it looks like you're describing something that we did. But in the international definition of terrorism are such things as efforts to coerce or intimidate a civilian population. Assassination? Oh. Kidnapping?
Yeah.
You know, it's all in there, and that's our law, and that's the definition of terrorism, but not when we do it.
Right, so we're in violation, or shall I state that our government is in violation of all the laws, the same laws that they are trying to impose on us and the rest of the world.
It's not quite that bad, because of course we are America after all, and we'll admit our mistakes and try to correct them when we can. But what I was trying to get across is that, you know, it all depends upon where you stand. Where you sit depends upon where you stand. And if you're in favor of, a Palestinian state, you're for that. And if you're in favor of having Israel run it forever, then you're for that. And it's awful hard to shake people's opinions, especially if they're well-developed and are supported by others that you may respect or admire. And in
well,
the Middle East... go ahead. Yes, sir, I'm sorry.
I'm a Ramallite, and I... You know, we don't mind people living with us. We don't mind people being there. We mind people trying to push us around, bully us, keep us from our normal routine. This is something that people, you know, nobody wants to be told what to do, what they can do, what they can't do on their own land. And also, we don't want land stolen from us. There's a lot that is there. It's not that we hate people. Hatred does not come from, people being kind to one another. Hatred comes from hatred incited by others.
Or perceived by others. Perception
right.
is the key. You know, what you perceive is what to you is right or wrong, good or bad, tasty or otherwise. And it's often difficult for people like you and me and people who are reasonable and rational to say, well, how can they possibly think that? And on the other side of the room, there are people saying the same thing about us. This is difficult to deal with. You know, I spent my adult life living in or working on other countries. Some of them were quite easy. Sweden was no problem at all. But in places like the Middle East, where it has been in a bloody turmoil for such a long period of time, taking Afghanistan as an example, and you want to make Afghanistan into a democracy, they don't know the meaning of the word, or election, or constitution, or political parties. You know, this is something that's totally removed from their experience and background. Remember this, my friend. We have the Constitution of the United States, the greatest instrument of its kind in the history of the world. But we had slavery for 47 years. And it took us 130 years to give the vote to the women. And in 1913, for the very first time, Americans elected senators instead of having them appointed by state legislatures as the Constitution had it. That was Amendment number 17, I think. So this is a tremendously difficult process. 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, we passed the Civil Rights Act. So
wow.
if the government expects that Afghanistan, boop, is going to become a functioning utopian democracy, they're smoking something pretty strong, because it is not going to happen. May not happen ever, but it certainly won't happen quickly.
You lead by example and not by force.
Yes, sir. That's good. That's very good. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to cut you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to cut you short, but we're running out on time. I'd skip through the break so we can get in as much time as we can.
Sir.
I would love to have you on again, sir. You're such an honest and decent man, and you're very outspoken on everything, which is great. And that's our job as Americans, to be outspoken and make sure that everything goes within the norm. Hopefully next week we will have on Vincent Bugliosi. We're not confirmed on that, but we will be trying hard. As you know, he put out a movie documentary called The Prosecution of an American President, and it will be releasing on iTunes and other certain channels, first run features, and other websites. So make sure you get a copy of the DVD of that, folks, and hopefully we'll see you next week. Thank you, Ambassador Peck, for joining us this evening.
You're
welcome. It's a pleasure having you. And join us next week here on live on the BBS Radio Network. This is Rock Cash saying have a good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.